This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how are you today? Great to have you along. This hour, the civil strife in Iran could affect the prices of some key commodities, things like oil, energy, and fertilisers. We'll look at that a little later this hour after the news headlines at 12:30. And shortly heading to the Kimberley, catching up with one of the cotton growers in the region just ahead of this season's plantings. And what are the expectations for the season ahead? We'll get to that shortly here on the Country Hour. 12:05 on the ABC WA and streaming live on the ABC Listen app. First today, a company planning to bring competition to the WA grains industry with a series of small transshipment ports in Western Australia is calling on the state government to contribute around about $2 million towards the approval process. The project was initiated in 2022 and has now identified three locations for these transshipment ports, which use a small vessel to transfer grain to a ship waiting in deep water off the coast. Kieran Carville is the General Manager of Seaports WA, a part of Sea Transport, a marine design and consulting service based on the Gold Coast in Queensland. He says these small, shallow ports could improve grain export efficiency and capacity and also reduce cost to growers by around about $10 to $15 a tonne. Kieran, what progress has been made to establish a transshipment port here in WA?
What we've been doing is we started sometime in during late 2022, and we have to date, we have done all of the, initially what we do is the metocean analysis is to check to see that what parts of the coastline are suitable for transshipment, because not all are suitable for transshipment. We then move from there after we select the initial sites from the ocean point of view. We then have a look at how those sites fit in with the domestic requirements, those domestic requirements being the bind into local roads and logistics, etc., the suitability within the grain catchment areas. There has been a huge amount of work done on that side to get us to a point where we could select sites. We have had a lot of ongoing work with the local stakeholders, be they the farmers groups, who have unanimously declared support for the idea of what we're doing and how we were looking to do it, with the various shires, the development corporations. So there's been a lot of work done with stakeholders, native title holders, etc. as well in a very early stage. So we've got ourselves to a position where we know where the ports go, that they work. We've done all of our financial background work, initial engineering, looking at port and vessel engineering so that we could develop our budgets, and have got to a position now where we need to start to go through the processes with environmentals, etc., to get through approvals.
What locations have been identified as ideal for one of these small, shallow water ports?
There's two of them on the west coast, one a little bit further north, one a bit further south. We are careful at this stage not to be too open with regards to what we're looking at, because there are interests out there that are contrary to ours.
So would you be able to say one in the Geraldton port zone, one in the Kwinana port zone? Are you able to put it into a zone?
So we have found two sites on the west coast. One would be within the Midwest ports area, and the other one would be down closer to the Fremantle ports area. And we've also found another suitable site on the south coast to the east of Albany.
So three ports you've got in mind, or three locations you've got in mind. What would the cost be here, Kieran?
Per supply chain, so we call a port upland storage sites of between three and five sites, subject to the area, all of the port silos and storage facilities, etc., the transshipment vessel. In total, we'd be talking about somewhere between $150 and $170 million per supply chain. And each supply chain, based off one transshipment vessel, being capable of loading up to about 3 million tonnes per annum. Naturally, transshipment ports can load a lot more volume than that. It's just a question of putting in more capital in order to expand the ability of the port.
And what are the advantages of a system like this compared to the traditional system, just exporting the grain through one of WA's established ports?
If we start off with looking at the situation as we see it at the moment, is the growers are not being able to move their grain efficiently through the system onto ocean-going vessels. There has been delays of, as we've seen, approximately about 30 days of vessels sitting outside Geraldton Port, for example, at $12,500 a day. That represents somewhere around $10 a tonne in cost to the growers, ultimately, through the trade, etc., but back to the growers. We're looking at reducing the actual haulage distance, which, you know, we're talking about somewhere around 100 kilometres on average in SA and what we did down there. We are looking at using back freight at the moment, where there are materials moved from the coastline back up to the farms, and that those trucks are coming empty out to the coastline. They're too far away from ports to make it sensible to move grain to the present ports and then pick up the back freight. However, where we're looking at placing the ports is very close to where this material moves from, and it represents a couple of million tonnes a year that's moved back in upcountry. So they'd have that advantage. We'd be able to move grain during the actual season, because we're seeing a lot of grain during seasons like this in WA, which will become more regular in the future, looking at the crop outlooks. That rolls over into the following season, which means that the growers then have the cost to carry plus the discount into the new season. We're seeing not enough segregation to growers having to move much further with their product to actually make the segregations that they need. You know, ultimately, and I think I actually heard it again recently on the ABC, where the discussion has been is that the train system can take 10 million tonnes a year, which means 16 million tonnes has to be moved on trucks. With moving the port to the farm, which are the port to the product, is what we do, is we reduce the haulage distance from the production area to the port, offering extra capacity on top of what's already there from the incumbent, enables in these years and in the future, as we said, we think that, you know, the crop looks like an average year of 26 to 30 million tonnes, as we see grain arable taking over from pastoral lands, etc., more of the coastal areas being used for production. This is going to be an ongoing issue with regards to capacity of the system and the eye of the needle. And we're there to, by bringing ports into place that are very cheap in comparison to deep water ports, and we're able to increase the system capacity to be able to move the grain efficiently.
So bottom line, what sort of savings does this offer for growers?
If we take the experience that we had in setting up T-ports in South Australia and then seeing how that has panned out, we're talking about an average logistical advantage between charges for fobbing, for storage and handling, plus also the trucking charges of $10 to $15. On top of that, what we have found is the increase in competition within the local market actually increases the competition and pricing back to the growers. And so if we have a look at the Geraldton area at the moment, it looks to be pricing $12 to $20 lower than other areas within South Australia. That's what we saw on the Eyre Peninsula until the introduction of true competition, and then the average comparative prices going back to the growers rose by between $10 and $25 a tonne. So, you know, we're talking about a significant change to that take-home by the growers, which can represent $30 to $40 a tonne.
This is the Country on the ABC at WA. It's 14 past 12. Kieran Carville is here today. He's the General Manager of Seaports WA, a part of Sea Transport, which is a marine design and consulting service based on the Gold Coast in Queensland. And he has plans to build three transshipment ports in WA, which he says could improve grain export efficiency and capacity and also reduce costs to growers by 10%. to $15 a tonne. Kieran, at this point, what is required to get your plan off the drawing board?
We have invested a number of years into this already ourselves, and we've funded everything on our own, and we have the solutions. So looking at everything and having the solutions, having support en masse out in WA, our issue is that we're having to invest a lot of money, but without any support from the other stakeholders at this stage on a financial basis. So we know that once we get through the approvals process that we've already done our predetermination work with regards to capital raise, and that will not be an issue. But we're looking to see that we can find gap funding for this part of the approvals process, which represents probably somewhere between $1.5 and $2 million per port.
And where would that come from? Are you looking specifically at state government or other investors?
We are looking at all investors, and of course we would look to state government. We think that bringing a solution that massively increases the efficiency and helps increase the returns to the growers is in their interest as well.
So you're looking for roughly $2 million from the state government to get this project through the approval process. Is that it?
Yes.
And what sort of feedback are you getting from the state government?
We have reached out to state government, and we are waiting replies for meetings with the Minister for Agriculture and other ministers.
And you said earlier there were quite a few groups in support of you, some local governments and also the farm groups. What about opposition or anyone less than enthusiastic about the concept?
Oh, I'm pretty sure there will only be one group who will be less than enthusiastic about the project. However, I would think that their shareholders are actually quite enthusiastic about the project.
Okay, so you're referring to the CBH Group, the state's main grain handler?
Of course, and in their position, I would be less than enthusiastic about competition entering into a state and being forced into a position to improve efficiency and competitiveness.
So how confident are you that this project will eventuate?
I'm confident that it is a solution that would fix the problems that are there, or a large amount of the problems that are there. I'm very confident about its economic that it stacks up economically. And then we have to wait and see as to what sort of support we see out there as to whether it moves forward or not.
And, you know, it's a slow process, as you said. I mean, it goes back to 2022, and there's so much to get through to even get to this point. The time frame for something like this, what's the vision here, Kieran? How far out are we, do you think?
Oh, the work that we've done over the last couple of years could have been done on a more expedited basis. That is quite clear. But like all people running businesses, we have to tend to the paying customers first, so that we can then look after projects like this out of the petty cash. So the timing moving forward, if we had the money on our bank account today to go through the environmental and approval process, is we're probably talking about a year and a half to 2 years in realistically speaking, even on an expedited basis, because there are certain elements of it that cannot be moved forward, and the regulatory process takes its time. The actual build time for port and transshipment vessel, port and all of the upland storage sites, etc., is about a year and a half, max 2 years, which is what has been done previously as well. The vessel itself is also about 2 years. So we're talking from today, we'll be talking about 4 years to then be up and running.
Kieran, really good to get an update on the project. Appreciate your time.
Belinda, thank you very, very much.
Kieran Carville, he's a general manager of Seaports WA. It's part of the Sea Transport Group, which is based on the Gold Coast in Queensland, and the company with plans to build 3 transshipment ports in WA and bringing that extra competition to the grains industry here in this state. What do you make of it? Do you like the idea? And the call also for the possibility of the state government to chip in around about $2 million towards the approval process for this project. What do you make of it? Are you a fan or not? Let me know on the text 0448 922 604. 20 past 12. Well, the state's main grain handler, the CBH Group, says shipping activity at the Geraldton port has been exceptionally strong, with more than 400,000 tonnes shipped in December, the second highest monthly total on record. But it doesn't seem to be moving fast enough for growers delivering to the port, who are having their grain, particularly their wheat, discounted by up to $20 a tonne compared to growers delivering to the Kwinana port. Now, earlier in the week, Plantfarm grain marketing advisor Jerem Critch said a perfect storm of limited capacity, a record production year and carryover tonnes from previous years have all contributed to this backlog of grain at the Geraldton port that CBH can't export quick enough to command price parity for growers in that region.
So that's not quite enough capacity in terms of exporting relative to what the port zone can produce. Then you've had just an absolute one out of the box production year, plus carryover tonnes from the previous year, plus traders getting their fingers a bit burnt with demurrage over the last few years, really, in the Geraldton port zone. And probably just to add on top of that, we've also seen probably some delays in infrastructure upgrades due to a number of big years, which are probably starting to impact overall capacity of export.
So how much of the responsibility of this lies with the state's main grain handler, the CBH Group?
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, probably 95% of it, really, in terms of the export capacity. I mean, they don't control production, which has been, in fairness to CBH, it's just been absolutely insane up in Geraldton. We've seen farmers who are hoping for a 2-tonne average who have averaged closer to 4-tonne and pretty widespread across the port zone. So, yeah, it's hard to probably gear up that much capacity without wasting money the 9 times out of 10 that it doesn't happen. So production side, there's not much they can do on that. It's phenomenal, exciting, amazing job by the farmers. But then on the capacity side, yeah, that's certainly very much in CBH's side of the court.
And so there really needs to be some money spent at the port in the future.
Yeah, and look, you're better off asking CBH these questions as to how they can crank up capacity. It's a full pipeline as well. It's not just at port. It's storing the grain, making sure it's well fumigated, making sure they can get it onto trains and trucks and into port. And then the port infrastructure is all working really well. I think they've had, and this is just from what I've heard, but I think they've been trying to make some improvements at port, but they've had a number of pretty decent years in a row. You think back over the last 5 years, we've had 4 very good ones up that way, and therefore they probably haven't had that breathing space to get in and make the improvements they needed to, plus a few personnel changes in the Geraldton port zone probably haven't really helped the situation.
Plantfarm grain marketing advisor Jerem Critch. And as Jerem said it, I'd be better off asking CBH those questions, and I totally agree. But CBH won't come on the show to discuss the situation at Geraldton, instead emailed a statement which says the Geraldton zone has delivered the largest harvest on record. The carryover at Geraldton going into harvest was about 200,000 tonnes, and shipping capacity at the port has been exceptionally strong, with more than 400,000 tonnes shipped in December. And shipping is running at about 30% above the usual pace for this time of year. It also says CBH invested a record of $590 million last financial year, including significant investment in the Geraldton zone. But what it doesn't answer is, does the co-op acknowledge that there's a problem at the Geraldton port? Why are growers in this zone having to take significant discounts for their grain? How much of that is CBH's responsibility? Now, Jerem says it's 95% the co-op's fault. Is that true? How much more investment needs to take place at Geraldton to make it more efficient? How long is this discounting going to continue? And what is CBH doing about it? Those questions are yet to be answered. 24 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
We'll get to the news headlines around about 12:30 today. First, though, to the Kimberley, where the new cotton gin is still a couple of weeks away from processing all of last year's cotton. Now, for the growers in the region, it's time to look forward to next season's crop, with planting expected to start in February. Cotton farmer Fritz Bolton says recent rains have made it difficult to prepare soils in the lead up to planting.
We've had a very wet start to the season and have, with that, probably being able to do a lot less soil prep than what we would normally do. We've also got a lot more stubble or cotton residue still in the ground from last year's big crop, and are anxiously awaiting a dry period in hopefully early February to be able to start.
Last year was the first really big crack at cotton here. What did you learn from that first season?
It was a very interesting season. It reminded me a lot of when we first grew sugarcane and our first, the start of our sugar industry, in that we had a collapse of commodity markets for sugar, which is the same that's happened for last year's cotton. And we also had some really adverse climatic conditions. We had late rain in May, a very early start to the wet season, and we had as many cold shock nights to the crop as what we can ever remember. So we end up with a start to the cotton cropping system that drew on our resilience quite a bit.
One of the big challenges that I remember speaking with you about was the crop was getting too tall and hard to pick. What went wrong there, and what are you going to change this time around to try and mitigate that?
Yeah, look, I think we just had one of those years that you might have every 10 or 15 years. There are a number of levers or management techniques that we can apply to curtail the vegetative growth of the cotton. But the main thing is the cotton needs to flower and have fruit load, and then it will not grow as tall and actually become quite productive. And because we had so many phases where we had rain, and with rain we get overcast weather, so we don't get the radiation and hence not the carbohydrate production for the crop, so it drops its fruit. So then it just goes back into a vegetative phase. I think it's unlikely we'll have another extreme season this year. We know we'll have them again, but in the future we'd probably irrigate less, but it's not known whether that would have a positive effect on the crops. Now, there's some plant growth regulators we can apply, but has only got limited effect. I think the main thing is that we need to maintain our positive attitude. We need to look to the future and understand that prices will be better, that input costs will reduce, and that we'll have some more normal seasons, and it'll be a lot of fun then.
Are you feeling optimistic about this year, or what are your emotions?
Look, the reality is that we've been communicating to our bankers that this year will still be a really tough year, simply because cotton prices are still going to be awful. And we're not communicating that because we want to be negative. It's just the reality. And we know that in the future, cotton will become more valuable and get used more. I mean, I still can't get my head around why people would buy synthetics and for clothing when it's such a dirty product. Now, from an environmental point of view, there's microplastics being discharged into the environment every time people do a wash, and when we discard that clothing, there's actually nothing we can do with it, whereas cotton just degrades, and it's a lot cleaner, environmentally friendly, and I think a much better product. So that's what we're aiming for, and that's what we're communicating to our banks, etc.
How much of a game changer has it been having the cotton gin open here in Kununurra?
Oh, absolutely everything, because really wasn't economical to send these volumes of cotton via truck over east. Just not reliable enough and too expensive. We also want to build the community here, and we want to have the cotton seed for local consumption here for the cattle locally.
Are you making any big changes? Are you doing anything differently with varieties or how you manage the crop, or is it mostly small tweaks that you're making this coming season?
Yeah, look, I think it's small tweaks that we're making. If we look back at 2025 and think that that's a normal season, well, then we're kidding ourselves. It's just not. There's going to be seasons where the crop is going to grow a lot better. Now, it's a very indeterminate crop, so it is very forgiving. And if you get the basics right, it will reward us. I just didn't do that last year. And as we understand the crop a bit better and understand the conditions more and more, we can tweak and fine-tune. And I think that will all benefit all of us. Now, it's got to be remembered that it's a sharing industry. So in other words, everybody in the region is willing to share what we've learned and willing to share the mistakes we've made. And so with that, you'll find that we'll have some really good results in the future.
Kimberley cotton grower Fritz Bolton from Oasis Farms. He was speaking to Jessica Baker. 12:30 here on the Country Hour, and Jonathan Hopper is in the studio. He's got the news headlines for you.
Good afternoon, Belinda. WA's commercial fish suppliers have come together to demand more data from the state government to justify the new restrictions on demersal fishing. Commercial harvesting of seafloor dwelling fish is now permanently banned between Kalbarri and Augusta, and catch restrictions are in place for several locations around WA. Phil Clark is a fish supplier and says he wants to see a survey of WA fish stocks from independent researchers. US President Donald Trump is due to attend a meeting with advisors about Iran after telling anti-government protesters help is on the way. International monitors say the death toll following more than 2 weeks of demonstrations has surpassed 2,000. And a shoulder injury has forced Tanasi Kokkinakis to pull out of his home tournament, the Adelaide International. The 29-year-old needed treatment on his right shoulder as he battled through a three-sets win over American Sebastian Korda. He'll now turn his focus to the Australian Open starting on Sunday. Thanks, Belinda.
Thank you for the update, Jonathan. 29-1. This hour we've been talking about plans to bring some competition to the WA grains industry, and we heard from Kieran Carville. He's the general manager of a company called Seaports WA, and the company has plans to construct a series of small transshipment ports here in WA, which he says could improve grain export efficiency, capacity, and also reduce costs to growers by sort of $10 to $15 a tonne. On the text, Jim says, CBH should employ this bloke and buy his company to take pressure off itself. Overall, it might save them and members money. We're also talking about the situation at the Geraldton Port this season, and Jerem Critch from Plan Farm just talking about some of the issues there contributing to the discounting that's going on for growers delivering in that port zone, up to $20 a tonne at some times, compared to growers delivering to the Kwinana port. That's the scale of the discount. On the text, Shannon says, CBH has done a phenomenal job this year. And this from TG, CBH now has to focus on grassroots. The overseas mills, etc., virtually failed with negligible value to growers. Geraldton this year, Kwinana next, it's predictable debate. And then this from Greg. Everyone has a short memory in regards to the Geraldton wheat prices. It was only 2 to 3 years ago that they were receiving prices $20 to $30 a tonne above Kwinana zone pricing. I didn't hear all the complaining back then. The text 0448 922 604 if you want to be part of the conversation. Shortly, we'll head to Katanning for the results of the sheep market. Pretty big yarding today. Almost 14,000 sheep yarded for sale at Katanning today. Tracy Kilner will go through those details. And we'll also head back to Queensland to look at the flood situation there for, in particular, livestock producers. We'll head to the Bureau of Meteorology next. Twenty-six to one on the ABC WA and on the ABC Listen app. Making our way to the Bureau of Meteorology now, and Angeline Prasad is with you this afternoon. Ange, what is the main feature affecting conditions across the Southwest Land Division this afternoon?
Good afternoon, Belle. So today we have got a West Coast draft that is deepening. It's still fairly mild out there. I'm not expecting much heat today in the environment. Maybe heat building through the central west and the far northern parts of the central lead belt. And just a couple of light showers along the south coastal districts today. The West Coast deepens further tomorrow and starts to move inland on Friday. So tomorrow it is going to drag in more heat into the southwest. So we see temperatures getting above 40 degrees across the northern parts of the central wheat belt and also the central west, the northern parts of the lower west tomorrow. And also with coupled with the dry heat, we'll see dry thunderstorms extend into the northern parts of the central reed belt tomorrow as well, including the inland parts of the central west. So tomorrow the dry thunderstorms, if they do happen, they'll be very isolated and stay to the north of Meriden. Now, as that West Coast trough moves inland on Friday, we see a lot more heat extend almost all the way down to the south coast. So if you look at temperatures, for example, in Meriden, we're looking at 42 degrees on Friday, the maximum. Waging, looking at 39 degrees on Friday, and Mount Barker getting up to 37. So there is going to be a lot of heat being dragged south as that West Coast trough moves inland on Friday. With that West Coast trough moving inland, we'll see the dry thunderstorms extend all the way down to the south coast. On both days, tomorrow and Friday, it's going to be very little rainfall, maybe 1 or 2 millimeters. There will be very isolated places where we could get rainfall sort of between 2 and 5 millimeters, but these are going to be fairly isolated. So fair bit of heat, elevated fire dangers as well over the next couple of days. The hottest day tomorrow will be on the west coast, and then the hottest day on Friday will be inland and southern parts of the Southwest Land Division. There's better weather on the way on Saturday and Sunday. So as this trough moves inland on Friday into Saturday, we'll see a weak cold front brush past the south coast. So a return to more drizzly, maybe light showers to the southern coastal districts as the west coast trough moves inland. There might still be lingering thunderstorms on Saturday, especially through the southern and eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division, but maybe slightly more moisture in the environment with that cold front coming through as well. Now, the cold front is going to bring in some good temperatures, so it's going to become quite mild on Saturday and Sunday across much of the Southwest Land Division. So better temperatures, a drop up of about 5 to 10 degrees with those milder change coming through. Following the cold front, weak cold front on Saturday and Sunday, we'll see another ridge develop initially across the southwest of the state, so across southwest WA, and that ridge will expand eastwards Sunday night into Monday, and we'll see a quick return of the West Coast trough again from Monday onwards.
And Ange, what have you got for northern and eastern parts of the state?
Well, there's a lot of heat building up across the northern parts, northern and central parts of the state as well, I should say. So there is a severe to extreme heat wave warning out. The severe heat wave is for the Kimberley, Pilbara, Gascoyne and the South Interior districts, and the extreme heat wave is for the North Interior district. There's really no strong systems to flush this heat out, so the heat just continues to build, and it's going to be a very prolonged, very hot spell across the northern and central parts of the state. So temperatures, daytime temperatures are going to hit the mid to high 40s. As we progress into the weekend and early next week, there will be some locations that may even nudge 50 degrees or get close to 50 degrees, or 49, 49.5, especially across western parts of the Pilbara. So really don't see this heat being flushed out until probably sometime next week. We are seeing isolated showers and thunderstorms through inland parts of the Gascoyne and through the Pilbara and the Kimberley. And the rainfall has been it's been a bit of a mixed bag. We're seeing more moisture across parts of the Kimberley. It has been a bit drier through the Pilbara. But there have been isolated thunderstorms that have been producing a little bit more rainfall. So generally, thunderstorms, if they do happen through inland parts of the Pilbara, inland Gascoyne, through the goldfields, through the interior, it's not going to produce much rainfall, 1 to 3 millimetres or 2 to 5 millimetres. But there will be thunderstorms, especially slow-moving ones that, you know, persist for a while, that could produce up 15 to 30 millimetres, for example. Certainly through inland parts and northern parts of the Kimberley, we'll see a bit more moisture in the environment, so getting up to that 15 to 30 millimetres with isolated falls are possible up to 50 millimetres. Thunderstorms, wherever they happen, will be quite gusty. Today and tomorrow, there's a risk of severe thunderstorms across the northern parts of the state, and so there's a risk of damaging winds from these thunderstorms. And in the south, where we do see those dry thunderstorms, there's a chance these thunderstorms will be quite gusty as well. Next week is interesting across the north. We may see a tropical low form, but there's a lot of uncertainty on where it will form and how much rain it will bring. So if the tropical low forms, it may bring some respite to the heat, but it's just very early days to talk about with any certainty at this stage.
All right. Well, thank you for the heads up anyway, Ange. Appreciate that. It is 19 to 1 here on the Country Hour to the rainfall results for WA over the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, and checking 5 millimetres and over, firstly in northern and eastern forecast districts. In the Kimberley, Doongan 9, Flora Valley 24, Halls Creek Airport 13, Lansdowne 7 and Mandorah 11. And then in the Pilbara, Chila Plains 23 and nothing over 5 millimetres in the Southwest Land Division, 19 to 1. Well, ex-tropical cyclone Koji has torn through Queensland's north, dumping hundreds of millimetres of rain and sending water to inland communities. Queensland graziers say multiple rain gauges failed during the major floods that have led to almost 50,000 cattle deaths. Premier David Crisafulli has called for more funding for rain gauges in Queensland, and Laura Lavelle has this report.
There's a lot of traumatised people. A lot of landowners have lost everything, all their cattle.
Found some our cows, one place over, jammed up the corner. Looking for the ones now, not looking for the hundreds.
Just sort of resigned yourself to losing 1,000 head or more, and then hope that by some miracle some of them survive.
The Queensland outback is underwater. 1.8 million hectares of land inundated. Stock losses are already in the tens of thousands and keep rising. A flood so large you can see it from space. From the air, the damage is obvious, but on the ground, knowing what's coming can be hard to predict.
There's no gauges, there's no warning to tell you that that's coming or going to happen. Like, it can happen in hours.
Grazier Ashley Gallagher is fed up with a persistent problem. Like many of its neighbours across the northwest, he relies on river gauges to know how much water is upstream, a critical tool when determining where and when to shift cattle during a flood. But this time, residents say many were offline or giving inaccurate readings.
So you're back to the old days, I guess, of ringing around stations to find out what's happening up the river instead of taking 5 minutes to look on the bomb page and see what's going on.
It cost him critical time as nearly a year's worth of rain fell in just days around Christmas. Thankfully, stock losses here are minimal so far.
Some of them didn't make it. Some of them are actually stranded on a little island because there's four big saltwater crocodiles sitting there waiting to take them. We actually tried to get them into the water, and these crocodiles attacked the cattle as they went into the water.
The situation is dire on his second station, Urella. 1,300 cattle reduced to mere dozens.
We can all handle an ordinary flood and a couple of weeks cut off, but these are just unprecedented sort of flooding events, and they just last forever.
...500 kilometres south in Richmond, graziers are also bracing for catastrophic losses.
That's some serious water coming up. We've never seen it do that before.
I've had those conversations where they said, no, they're all gone. I don't mean washed away, they've died in the paddock. It's a combination of everything. Cattle have died in the paddock from pneumonia and it's just from weariness.
More than 48,500 head. The estimated number of cattle killed in northwest Queensland this disaster so far. That figure will rise when the water recedes and graziers can inspect their land. The region has been hit by catastrophic floods before, including recently in 2019.
It was like a car accident. It happened really quickly, whereas this one is more similar to what they call the 74 flood, and it's been very slow and drawn out, and I say it's like someone being on a ventilator or life support.
River gauges are owned by a patchwork of government agencies, including the Bureau of Meteorology, but the Richmond Mayor says they need to be managed and maintained by just one entity.
And you can save a lot of cattle if the gauges are all working. And you save a lot of stress and you save a lot of loss. So gauges are very, very important.
The Weather Bureau told 7.30 two of its automatic gauges on the Flinders River are currently out of service, and a number owned by state and local governments are also out of action. Once the site is accessible and inspections can take place, the Bureau will confirm the extent of the damage.
There is a real challenge in the gauges. I think it's not a straightforward one.
Dr. Pete Follett is an expert on waterways. He says managing the state's flood warning system is extremely complex.
I think it's just the tyranny of distance, our size. They're owned by multiple organisations, a mixture of BOM ones, which are the really high-tech, high-specification. We have state government ones, we have local government ones, water utilities, the odd mining company, and maybe the other private ones.
What can cause a flood gauge to go out of action?
Often the most big challenge one is that if you did get a big pulse go through, a lot of it is really maintenance.
The Queensland government says the gauges it owns were operational during the flood.
My criticism of the Bureau is not of those who work there, it's of the lack of funding that has gone there to upgrade those facilities over a long period of time.
Councils are stretched big time. Like, to have someone who has this as part of their portfolio is, I think, a real challenge. So they need support.
To centralise the system, the federal government says it's in the process of buying back a third of the 3,300 gauges in Queensland and upgrading existing ones at a cost of $236 million over 10 years. But that's little comfort for these graziers.
The working river gauges, they're a lifesaver. They're saving cattle's lives anyway, and sometimes human life when they're working.
Ashley Gallagher, ending that report from Laura Lavelle. And you can watch that whole story from the 7.30 report on iView. And what about here in WA? What do you think of the weather stations, the rain or river gauges in your area? Are they up and running, out of action? Repairs take too long? Is more funding needed? Like they're calling for in Queensland, let me know. 0448 922 604 to text through and have your say. 11 minutes to one. The civil strife in Iran could affect the prices of some key commodities, including oil, energy, and fertilisers. Iran exports about 10% of the world's urea, and any push by US President Trump to restrict trade with Iran could put a stranglehold on supply and force up prices. Commodity analyst Andrew Whitelaw says recent history shows just how quickly urea prices can escalate.
All we have to do is look back to last June when Israel, the US and Iran were in a little bit of a early stages of a conflict, and then the urea price went absolutely through the roof. And that was off the back of energy prices. Because one of the things we've got to remember is that energy prices are what drive urea pricing. And so when there's that risk of some sort of barriers to the trade in energy, and Iran, you know, controls the Strait of Hormuz, which is about 20% of the world's energy goes through there. If there's a concern that there's going to be restrictions or lack of access, then energy prices go through the roof, and then that flows through to urea. And sort of secondly, like, it's an interesting one, because if you look at the countries who actually trade with Iran, and Donald Trump has said that he'll make companies pay a 25% tariff if they continue to trade with Iran. One of the big traders with Iran is China. So I guess if a 25% tariff is added on to China, then it will be it could be the restarting of that China-US trade war, which was looking like it was getting, you know, fixed. But I think it's an interesting one, because we are in a situation where Trump has said that he's going to put a tariff on countries that continue to have Iran, but it's pretty hard to actually track in real time whether a country is actually trading with another country or not. So it's going to be an interesting time to see what happens there.
They also do a lot of wheat trade with Russia too, don't they? So there may be, you know, we might see tariffs on, more increasing tariffs on Russia?
Yeah, like Russia and Iran trade are also another nation that trade a lot with Iran. So is Iraq, Pakistan, I believe, as well, is another one, and India. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to be a situation where, if we forget about the tariffs for a second, we just think about the instability and the potential for regime change. The reality is that could have a negative on our urea pricing, because it all depends on how long and how messy it gets over there. If it becomes a nice clean regime change, then things might not change. But if it, you know, turns into protracted civil war / conflict, then we could see prices spike up, because at the end of the day, they produce about 10% of the world's trade in urea, and countries might start to think, well, actually, I'm not going to buy in urea from Iran because they don't want to get hit with any tariffs. So it might mean there'll be a de facto sort of end of Iranian urea for a while, whilst other countries compete for other origins other than Iran.
And it's at a time when Australian farmers will be looking around for urea, looking around for fertiliser, Trump putting a crop.
Probably looking more for your phosphates at this point for seeding, but at the end of the day, people will be looking to start making a purchasing decision between now and seeding, and we could see, if this conflict rises, increases in prices. Because if we look at our urea price at the moment, it's sort of at the level it was prior to June last year, but then we saw in June the market just absolutely rally because of gas prices going up in the Middle East, but also, you know, a lot of plants shutting down. But from a positive point of view, if the energy price goes up, if crude oil prices, you know, go absolutely gangbusters and gas prices go gangbusters, yes, our fuel for harvesting and seeding will go up, our fertilizers will go up. And generally, when crude oil prices go up, so does corn, wheat and barley prices and canola.
So, yeah, other commodity prices follow.
Other commodity prices follow, especially the grains, because they are substitutable into the energy market.
So we don't do, it shouldn't really be a problem for us to worry about a 25% tariff from Trump on Australian goods, because we just don't do that sort of much trade with the wheat or beef or lamb or barley with Iran.
Well, we do a little bits of grain with Iran, but what I would say is I don't think it's going to be a particularly big issue. Like, the volumes we've done, like last year, you know, if we look at the top 10 countries that we trade with, Iran featured in the top 10 of barley in 10th place, probably about 100,000 tons or so, so very, very small volumes. And I don't know how strong this tariff from Trump will be, whether it actually becomes a law or not, and how easy it is for a country to track another country's trade in real time. I wouldn't worry too much about it at the present.
Well, the Supreme Court might determine that those tariffs are actually illegal, because they're looking at it now.
Yeah, and that's the situation we're in just now, is a sort of very fluid environment. In fact, we've been in a very fluid environment since Trump took office. But I think it's definitely a concern, the civil instability in Iran, because it does have a flow-on effect to the rest of the world. So I think we can't ignore it.
The other issue, you mentioned the fuel prices there, and if fuel prices skyrocket and diesel prices go up and people are wanting to put a crop in, so that could be an impost that people weren't expecting too.
Absolutely, and it just depends on how long the conflict goes and how messy it becomes. But again, like I was saying before, it's got negatives and it's got positives. Negatives, higher fuel pricing, higher fertilizer pricing. Positives are potential for higher grain pricing as well. Energy prices and grain prices follow each other with a very strong correlation.
Andrew Whitelaw, commodity analyst at episode3.net, speaking to Michael Condon, 5 to 1. The WA Agricultural Research Collaboration, or WARC, has joined forces with the Grower Group Alliance to give university honours students a new way to connect with local grower groups. Jenny Crisp from WARC says this is a unique chance to build skills out in the field.
So what the program offers is a $10,000 scholarship for students who take on an honours research project in conjunction with a grower group. They also get some funds for travel to help them get to the region. So, you know, that's not limiting them in being connected to a grower group. WARC has, for the last couple of years, had a PhD program, which is, you know, three and a half to 4 years for students, and we've provided scholarships for that. We want to expand into the honours area, mainly because it's a lower investment of time. It's less than a year as opposed to four. And, you know, with the $10,000 in incentive, we're hoping to attract particularly domestic students into doing an honours year because, you know, there are great jobs out there. So our undergrads are often going straight into jobs. And we'd like to keep them in to get a bit more of the research, to get more skills in actually doing applied research. So that's sort of what we're trying to encourage with the program.
So your hopes are basically you have these honours students, they're going to connect with some local grower groups. And yep. What are they going to walk away with at the end of that program?
Well, they'll have an honours degree, they'll have their honours, they'll have written a dissertation and done their honours. But the difference with not doing it, you know, attached to a grower group or in conjunction with a grower group, is that they'll have done research that they know is relevant and is a priority for our WA growers, and they'll have a better understanding of, you know, what farmers go through, really, what growers go through. So it's sort of less about a lab and glass houses, although they may well be doing those experiments as well, but they'll just have a much better grounding in why they're doing what they do.
And what sort of research, Jenny, do you think students might find themselves working in?
Well, the beauty is it can actually be anything. The key is that it would be connected and a need for the group. So the group would put up a number of topics that they would like to do. We try and connect with a supervisor who is also, you know, that's a topic area that they are familiar with. And then we connect with a student who wants to do that. So it's a bit of it. So the topic can be anything that's of use of value to the group, basically, but it could be cropping and livestock, you know, water, carbon, renewable energy, just data decision making. But the groups will guide what is of relevance to them, as well as students who might have just finished their undergrad. It could also be someone who's out there possibly working in the regions or in the ag sector who's interested in coming back to an honours. I just wanted to add that. Yeah, calling out all students, really.
Jenny Crisp, who's the Capacity Building and Extension Coordinator with the WA Agricultural Research Collaboration, or WARC. And she was speaking to Kate Forrester. Let's make our way now to Katanning for the results of the sheep market. Tracy Kilner, hello. What were the numbers like today?
Numbers were up over 6,000 head for a total yarding of 13,876 sheep and lambs at Katanning. A very average quality yarding, with most categories trending up, with negative fluctuations only reflecting the quality. The lamb yarding was dominated by lightweights and unfinished lambs, but all weight categories gained with demand. Mutton returned to last year's values with increased demand, especially the store lines. The lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from $20 up to $193. Heavier lambs made from $163 to $220 a head. Trade weight lambs sold from $196 to $260, and heavy weights from $229 up to $293 a head. The ram lambs sold to processors from $90 to $248. Merino store weather hoggets sold from $74 to $140, while the medium and heavy weights made from $170 up to $220 a head. The merino ewe hoggets returned from $80 to $150 for lightweight stores, and the medium and heavy weights made from $141 to $201 a head. Store mutton sold from $60 for the very lightweight ewes up to $192. Prime medium weights returned from 170 to 209, and heavy weights over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $200 to $220 a head. Mature store wethers made from 68 to 180, and the medium and heavy weights sold from 178 up to $230. Mature rams made from 50 to $206. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you for going through those details. Tomorrow we head to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market. I'll talk to you then on the ABC WA Newstime, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.